All right, good morning, everyone. Good morning, good morning. Thank you for being here. I'm Robert Fishman. We're excited to welcome Lachlan Murdoch back at the conference. Looking back on the past year since you were here, lots to discuss, as you heard from all my questions on the earnings call.
Those who didn't listen to the earnings call, Robert asked, like, seven questions in the first minute.
Yeah.
Which I loved. All the other analysts were upset that you'd taken all their questions. You left nothing, nothing for them.
Right.
So you did a great job.
Well, do you know where Robert worked before MoffettNathanson? I'm not saying.
Okay.
Just people with his history.
Let's dig in.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you.
No, it's great. So let's go back. It's been a very busy and interesting year for Fox so far. So let's start with the proposal to bring News Corp and Fox together. Initially, it was announced back in October and then ended up getting withdrawn in January. Anything that you can share further about what went into that initial decision and then the reasons for ending up withdrawing it a few months later?
Sure. Thank you, Robert. And I can't believe that's this year. It feels like much longer ago. First, it's more to say that there was no concrete proposal to bring the companies together. We never got that far. What happened was, you know, we suggested to the independent directors of both boards of News Corp and Fox that it was worth considering what the merits of a combination would be, and that's really what it was. So there was no actually concrete proposal that anyone at the end of the day got to decide upon. But the thinking behind that, right, the germination of that idea was really how do we broaden our geographic spread? You know, Fox in particular, you know, the News Corp is a global company. Fox is really, you know, focused in the United States, which has served us incredibly well. But as we look to expand, we look to grow, a combination with News Corp, we thought conceivably would broaden our geographic spread. We also are always looking at how we further engage with our audience, right? And we are Fox, we are, you know, deeply invested in news and sports, the news and sports verticals, and again, that served us incredibly well. But how do we deepen that engagement? And of course, a combination with News Corp, which is also very strong in both news and sports, would have made a tremendous amount of sense. Also, on paper, again, without a concrete proposal to judge, it's hard to know this, but it looked like a transaction could be very accretive to all shareholders. So that's why we proposed to the two boards to consider it, but do it appropriately and in the best way with governance, with just their independent committees. In the middle of that process, CoStar made a bid for one of News Corp's, you know, very valuable assets in Realtor. And that bid, had it gone forward, would have taken some time, would have needed regulatory approval, would have taken a long time to close, and it made a combination just far too complicated. So we've decided to pull back.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you know, we've been steadfast in our support of Fox on valuation, not even alone, but valuation, so, you know, so supportive. Can you talk a bit about, you know, has your view changed about the future of your strategy, sports and news, given the shifting pay TV landscape, right? So is there any change in your, you know, strategy you set up a couple of years ago, given what you've seen happen?
Look, strategies is always moves, right? If you fix a strategy and you don't adjust it, right? And you don't consider adjustments as you move forward. Obviously, you said the ecosystem is changing, you know, quickly, right, rapidly. And so you have to be flexible in terms of how you compete within that ecosystem. But when you think about, you know, the media ecosystem, and there's a lot of talk, you know, we're bundled into or connected with, you know, other media companies. Obviously, you heard a terrific presentation from Disney just before. But the ecosystem is very complex, right? And very complicated. So when we look at the media ecosystem, you know, we believe that we've chosen, right, to live and exist in part of the ecosystem that's radically different from the rest of the media ecosystem, you know, from the way I look at it. If you and we've chosen that. When we sold our entertainment assets to Disney, we proactively were choosing to live in the part of the media ecosystem which we think is the best, which is in news, live news, and then live sport as our primary focus. So I guess the analogy, if you want to extend that, is like, if you got the global ecosystem, and it's complicated and sometimes challenged. You've got the jungle where you have, you know, the howling monkeys and the pumas and the boa constrictors, and you've got beachfront, right? And we like to think we're in the beachfront, you know, where audiences are moving, where advertisers, you know, value the most, where our distributors value the most, and we can see continued growth in our part of the ecosystem.
Okay, great. So let's switch over to the biggest driver.
Also, I should just finish on that, because that was the first part of Michael's question. When you then look at why we think it's so, where we exist is so important, it's frankly because our brands in those, it's not just that it's news and sport, then we have the strongest news brands, we have the strongest sports brand, the tremendous businesses. We're at the beginning of a 3-year distribution cycle. In the first year of that cycle, you know, we've seen pricing fixed, you know, at or above our expectations, to be frank. We have new growth assets like Tubi that fit very well within that ecosystem that give us a lot of growth and are exciting, and I hope we get a chance to talk about Tubi later this morning. And beyond all that, like we have an incredibly strong balance sheet, which allows us both to invest in those businesses, organically invest in those businesses, to look at kind of a strategic M&A, and also, which is equally important to us, to return value to shareholders in the form of you know significant dividends and a buyback. So when you add all that up together, you know, we feel, you know, very confident and happy with to be able to compete and continue to grow in where we sit in the landscape.
Okay, so it's a great setup for the next set of questions coming. So let's dive in on the biggest driver of the company's cash flows, which is Fox News. Clearly gotten a lot of attention again over the past couple months. After the Dominion settlement, will Fox News leadership do anything differently to not place shareholders in future jeopardy of more litigation?
So the question is, how do we not get sued? Well, you know, yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, we could be CNN, right? Last week, we can look at factually. CNN had a town hall with the former president, where he made a lot of allegations about the 2000 election. If you believe, and I haven't seen a lawsuit yet, maybe there's one coming, but I'm not going to hold my breath. If you believe it's newsworthy to have, you know, a former president, also a candidate for the next presidential election, you know, if you believe it's, that's newsworthy in 2003, well, certainly it was newsworthy in 2020 to report on similar allegations. So what happened in the Dominion case, though, was we were denied our ability to rely on a First Amendment defense, and we were denied an ability to rely on newsworthiness, which meant, almost by definition, we're going to be in a multi-year prolonged legal battle, which we'd ultimately win. But the distraction to the company, the distraction to our growth plans, our management, would have been extraordinarily costly, which is why we decided to settle. But ultimately, it was a difficult decision to make, but the right decision, because I don't believe Fox News or any of our hosts engaged in any defamation during the whole period. But it was the right business decision to settle.
I kind of follow that on the removal of Tucker Carlson from Fox News. Any additional color on the reasons? And are there more opportunities to better monetize Fox News with national advertisers, right? So it's two separate questions, but, you know, we're very aware of who's advertising at Fox primetime, right? So
the first question
is any shedding more light on kind of the reasons, the color for the removal of Tucker Carlson?
And second question, advertising. Yeah. So I'm not. The answer is I'm not going to go into programming decisions at Fox News. Short of saying that all of our programming decisions are made with the long-term interests of the Fox News brand and the Fox News business at heart. So we make those decisions really thinking, you know, broadly or long-term in terms of what's the best thing for the company in the long term. And we've done it before, right? Bill O'Reilly, you know, was a superstar. Megyn Kelly was a superstar. Glenn Beck was a superstar. And we're able to move forward with programming decisions that ultimately result in the long-term growth and profitability of the business. So that's number one. From an advertising point of view, you know, the whole business is incredibly strong, including, you know, still at 8:00, and we're seeing advertising, if anything, strengthen at Fox News rather than weaken.
So you touched on this a little bit earlier, but can you talk a little bit more about Fox News' negotiating power to seek higher affiliate fees from distributors despite the recent developments?
Well, Fox News' ability to drive affiliate fees is because of the decisions we make at Fox News, not despite of those decisions. So, we proactively make decisions, as I said, you know, for the long-term interest of the business, and we will continue to do so. So when I think about what that results in, what the actual outcome of that is, and why we continue to garner and justify or, you know, the most premium pricing in the market is because of the strength of the whole channel, and I should also add Fox Business News and now Fox Weather. So, you know, we look at, let me just a couple of statistics, right? A recent survey had, you know, well, Fox News has been number one in news, cable news, for 21 years. We've been number one. I'm sorry to have my back to everyone on this side of the audience. We're number one in all of cable for 7 years. A recent survey of news viewers, Fox News is the most trusted news provider by, I think, 42%. CNN and MSNBC were, I think, relatively 22% and 18%. So, you know, practically double each of our competitors' trustworthiness in news. And then we look at, I should show you. We look at, I'll tell you. We look at ratings the same way you'd look at stock prices. And perhaps not in as sophisticated a way as you do, but currently, right? So since the changes, Robert, that you mentioned, right? We're in the 25-54 demo, which is the key demo for news, right? 18-49 is key for entertainment. 25-54 is the key demo for news. This is up to date from this morning. Fox and Friends, number one. Fox and Friends First, number one. Fox and Friends, number one. American Newsroom, number one. Faulkner Focus, number one. Outnumbered, number one. America Reports, number one. The Story, number one. The Five, number one. Special Report, Bret Baier, number one. Jesse Watters Primetime, oh, and number one. And of course, Fox News Tonight at 8:00 P.M., so without Tucker, number one. Hannity, number one. Ingraham Engle, number one. Gutfeld, number one. And Fox News at Night, number one. So, we look at the breadth of our programming, and we're very confident with the strength that we have in these numbers, that we're gonna continue to drive premium pricing with our distributors.
You talked about Tubi earlier, and it was a big focus of your upfront on Monday. You announced the creation of now the Tubi Media Group. Can you help us think about the revenue growth profile of those assets, and maybe more importantly, the profit outlook at some point in terms of, you know, how profitable could these businesses be?
The revenue growth profile of Tubi is off the charts, right? It's growing like a weed, right? And importantly, it's growing like a weed first because our key metric, which is total viewing time, you know, continues to grow and outpace revenue growth. So what that means is that, you know, we have more and more availabilities to offer our advertisers, our clients, and we have more room, or dramatically more room, to monetize those availabilities further. So the growth profile is tremendous. I'm just glad. Look at the stare that Gabby has at me. I'm not allowed to say just how good it is. But the underlying performance of business is going incredibly well. From an, I think the second part of your question, Michael, was around the investment in it.
Yeah.
With a business with this growth profile, and also its position in how audiences are viewing television and how audiences are gonna continue to view television going forward. Particularly, we're talking here entertainment television, specifically entertainment television. It's prudent and wise to continue to invest in this business at around the same level for the next couple of years, which is in the $200 to $300 million range.
So you mentioned,
I should say is very modest compared to what some of our peers are spending on their subscription video on demand platforms.
So Michael alluded to how featured Tubi was as part of the upfront presentation. Can you maybe expand upon how it's different this year versus last year? How much is it being incorporated as part of the upfront?
It's a great question, and there's a subtlety to it because we've put Tubi at the center of our upfronts, right? Anyone who was at our presentation on Monday would see that, you know, not only did Marion Gambelli do a tremendous job talking about Tubi in her introduction to the whole upfront and really putting it front and center, but then our first presentation from our key business units, being, you know, sports and news and entertainment, the first presentation was from Tubi. And that was obviously very purposeful because it's a business we want to highlight, but it's also a business that offers, you know, tremendous value to clients and advertisers, and we really want them to understand that and to know that. We don't, though, hard bundle, and so Tubi will be part of all of our conversations. It's critical to know, and this is the subtlety, though, we don't force bundle or staple Tubi revenue with the rest of our revenue. So we don't go to clients and say, if you want to get into Fox Sports, you have to be in Tubi. We don't do that because we think Tubi stands alone, and the track record is that Tubi stands alone in its value to clients and advertisers, and is able to grow at these, you know, really tremendous rates without having to force couple them. It really is new revenue to us.
And where do you think those ad budgets are coming from that are driving Tubi?
So it's really interesting. They're incremental to us. They're not cannibalistic. In entertainment, and this is just a point sort of generally in the media environment, as you're seeing, so the subscription video on demand services, you know, led by I suppose Netflix and Disney Plus and others, you know, are bringing entertainment ratings down, particularly cable entertainment. But obviously, you're seeing a deterioration of entertainment ratings. And what that means is that clients, traditional, big, national advertising clients, aren't getting the reach anymore that they used to get just advertising nationally on entertainment, whether that's broadcast entertainment or cable entertainment. So their traditional national ad buyers are becoming less and less efficient with less and less reach. So you have to go and add additional reach onto those buys. And we find with Tubi, and we've done this research for a lot of our clients, these traditional national clients, we add anywhere between 75 and 95% more reach to a traditional linear ad buy when you add Tubi to that. And that's because Tubi's audience is younger, it's very diverse, and obviously very, very engaged with the product. So it's a great asset for us to have, but it's a great asset for our advertisers and clients to utilize, and they are.
So it's a great setup for our next topic, talking about reach. So let's shift to Fox Sports. Can you discuss how Fox's strategy to keep all of its premium content, including and especially the NFL, exclusive to the pay TV, impacts your relationships and the negotiations with the distributors and your affiliates that you talked about earlier?
So Fox has a perhaps more unique strategy in that we're keeping our premium sports, and NFL being the most premium for us, we're keeping our premium sports on our broadcast network, which means that it's exclusive to the broadcast and cable environment where our channels are retransmitted. And we think that's very important because we think that the traditional pay TV ecosystem is still the ecosystem that serves consumers best, serves the leagues best with the most reach, and serves advertising clients. And so we're going to continue to do that because that's unique. We think we can push, and it's been proven in our results, you know, premium rates and premium retransmission revenue.
Is that true also from a net retrans basis too, that your the stations that are Fox affiliates, when they go into their own negotiations, do you think they're getting treated differently than the ones who are maybe representing networks that have lead content over the top as well?
Yes, and certainly we are when we do those negotiations, which is obviously a large amount of the time. And so when we are able to go to a distributor and say, look, we're not competing with you, right? We're not asking our audience, our viewers, to choose between your distribution, your pay TV platform, and our own subscription video on demand platform. And so we are adding value, exclusive value to your platform. People, the only way to watch, you know, America's Game of the Week on Sunday afternoon is through your platform in your market. And we think that's tremendously valuable to them, and so do they.
So what we've been waiting to see, we call the people who leak the rights over the top cheaters, because they're basically getting paid two ways. At what point do you think there'll be some type of penalty besides slowing affiliate fees? Do you think there's going to be any kind of, you know, sea change in what distributors pay for when more and more of the rights go over the top?
Look, I think it's share of wallet, right? And so, you know, obviously a consumer is going to only spend at some point, you know, so much on their pay TV bundle, right? Whether it's pay TV bundle or pay TV bundle combined with, you know, video on demand, subscription video on demand offerings. So there's only so much share of the wallet you can get. And what we found is, and what's been very successful talking with our distributors, is that if our sport is exclusive, we deserve a higher share of the wallet, right? So we have to take that value from somewhere. And frankly, we're taking it from our competitors that are spreading out their premium sports content on too many platforms. Yeah.
So maybe just to follow up on that, and again, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, but anything more you can talk about that pricing increase that you are getting, maybe ahead of your expectations that you mentioned, to offset what we all know, that the higher levels of cord cutting?
So on the pricing, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we are one year into a three-year cycle, right, where we renew all of our distributors. And what we're seeing in that cycle is we've set a price both for retransmission and our cable channels in the market that exceeds our expectations. So we are driving, I think, best-in-class pricing increases, and our brands, because where we sit in the ecosystem we've talked about, that's what gives us the ability to do that. So 100% we are sort of best-in-class premium pricing. What happens in the cable ecosystem overall? You know, obviously we're seeing, you know, declines of, you know, over 7%. That's something we can't, you know, we can't control that side of the ledger, but absolutely we can garner within that the highest pricing increases.
So this is a frequent question for Bob Iger, but now it's going to be one you, Lachlan.
That's a comment that makes me nervous.
No, it's, you know, you've been clear with your strategy. Yeah. It's optimized for the world we're living in today.
How does Bob answer the question?
he's like, well, this is the best strategy we have today because consumers choose the bundle.
Yeah.
But at some point, how do you think about the option to take your sports content in the years ahead over the top, given that you have these rights and the rights are valuable?
Yeah, it's a great question. The true answer to the question is what's the best for the consumer, right? And at the moment, you know, if you want to watch all the sports you can possibly watch, you want to get every sport in America, you're a crazy sports fan, you want to pay the lowest price for it with the least amount of friction of having to swap in and out of, you know, multiple different services and, you know, different boxes on your TV. The best, and if you're, so for the consumer, I'll go on to the leagues, but the best service you have today is a traditional cable pay TV bundle, right? Or satellite cable pay TV bundle. That today is serving the consumer the best, right? It's probably the lowest price when you add them all up. You have a tremendous amount of reach. It's very simple to change channels between the sports. You get everything all in one place. Having said that, technologies change and consumers change, behaviors change. And so as that changes, you know, we think if you have premium sports, you're number one sports business, number one news business in the country, we will be on, you know, every scaled platform, not relying on what technology that's delivered in, right? So this, whatever technology it is, whether it's a streaming service, whether it's a cable TV service, whether it's a satellite service or some other service, some app that we haven't invented yet, our brands will be, you know, integral to any of those businesses at scale, regardless of the technology. We feel very well positioned there.
So maybe just the follow-up to hit it home a little bit further. Are you willing to work with other sports networks to make that central hub for sports, to find that place online, to find all the different rights in one place?
I think you have to put the consumer first. So the answer is yes. If we can offer our consumers, you know, the best possible experience where they can engage with the best content, we're absolutely open to those conversations. Today, that is the pay TV bundle. You know, that will change over time.
Yeah, I mean, we've known you for a while. We keep going back to the thesis that the virtual build-out has not evolved the way we all thought, right? The virtual build-out, it's too big, the bundle.
Yep.
Price is too high. We keep waiting for someone to slim it back to what people actually want, which is sports and news.
Yep. Well, we used to call it the Reese like to call it, never called on, but the skinny bundle, right? Not the skinny bundle, or the core bundle, right?
Right.
So the skinny bundle, the core bundle. What do people watch 95% of the time or 90% of the time? You know, can you create that bundle without all the add-ons?
Right.
So, but it hasn't happened.
As sports fans, it's totally frustrating to go from app to app to app to app. Okay. So can you discuss your appetite to bid on new sports rights like the NBA, who will be here tomorrow, and why the leagues will look to partner with you instead of digital bidders who have a bigger balance sheet, but why do they choose to partner with you? So more appetite for more sports.
Yeah.
And what are you offering leagues that they can't find with people who have bigger balance sheets?
The NBA is easy. I hate to disappoint your guests tomorrow, but we are highly unlikely to bid on the NBA. You know, we look at our sports portfolio and try to balance it overall. And in doing so, I think it's highly unlikely that we would bid on the NBA. But overall, why would sports leagues choose to partner with us as opposed to people with bigger balance sheets? Maybe not more healthy balance sheets, but bigger balance sheets. And look, the answer to that is really reach, right? Broadcast is still the best place for sports to be. And frankly, if I were an NFL owner or an NBA owner, team owner, I would want to be on broadcast TV. When we had Thursday Night Football, you know, a few years ago, and it was simulcast, right? So we had it live on Fox, Thursday Night Football, and we simulcast it with the NFL Network and with Amazon. Those games that were simulcast, 95% of the viewing was on broadcast TV, was on Fox. 5% was shared between Amazon and Thursday Night Football. Then when we moved on from Thursday Night Football and gave it up, and we released it a year early, and it went on Amazon last year for the first year, Amazon's reach is down on average, if we look at the average of our season the year before, 42%. And by the way, that includes local market broadcast, so it's less than 42% on the app. If I were an NFL owner, that's a disaster for me. And so, you know, sports leagues, their owners really need to think carefully about, you know, the value of the sports, as national brands, reaching as many Americans as possible. And that's why, to your question, Michael, you know, if I were a sports owner or a commissioner of sports, I'd want to be on broadcast, make sure it's on broadcast more than anything else.
So you do have some sports rights that are coming due over the next couple of years, WWE, World Cup, Pac-12, and NASCAR, to name a few. How do you measure, as you just mentioned with NBA, like when do you have too much sports, or how do you evaluate those decisions as they're coming up?
We do it constantly and in real time as rights emerge. We look at all our renewals, you know, very seriously. We have tremendous partners, you know, WWE and NASCAR have been tremendous partners of ours for a long time, particularly along with NASCAR. And we value those relationships. But we have to balance the portfolio. If you look at sports that we have passed on, that's as important as the ones that we've renewed. It shows, I think, the discipline of our approach. UFC, we used to broadcast UFC. We don't broadcast UFC anymore. We gave up those rights. Golf, we used to broadcast some golf. We passed on those rights. And we look at, you know, the value of them both to our distribution partners and also from an advertising perspective.
Can you answer also that question, how it relates to what you're doing with the USFL, maybe what you're learning, building out your own league, and how that may inform your decision to go forward with certain types of investments in sports?
Sure. So, we're an entrepreneurial company. We like to build businesses. I think, you know, in most of our, the majority, the lion's share of our successes have been building businesses, as opposed to, you know, to acquiring businesses. And the USFL is a great example of that. You know, USFL is a tremendous model. We're in our second season. It's doing very well. And we felt there was an opportunity in the market for a spring sports league, which NFL football league, which is proving right. So we'll continue to see how that goes. We'll continue to invest in it. Importantly, it's broadcast with a broadcast partner, NBC. So again, that gives it the most possible reach we can give it to afford its success, so.
Let's shift over to sports betting for a second. Now that the FanDuel arbitration is finally behind us, we actually had FanDuel Flutter here yesterday. Can you speak to the overall relationship with Flutter, and including how you feel about their upcoming U.S. listing?
So, I'm very excited about the U.S. listing. I think they're a tremendously run company. We now believe, like, our value and our relationship with Flutter is really, you know, as a option holder in their FanDuel business. And people forget, as a shareholder in Flutter today. So we have two exposures to their business today. We have the 18.6% option in FanDuel. We think their U.S. listing obviously will be reflective of the value that FanDuel has as the leader in sports betting in this country. Our 18.6% option is a 10-year option that we think is tremendously valuable. We also, and people forget this, we, you know, part of our relationship with Flutter, we invested in Flutter. I think our investment today, this is a few years ago, our investment today is worth over $875 million, that's sitting on the balance sheet that no one really looks at, but Steve's not hiding it anywhere. It's there if you do the math. So, and their U.S. listing, I think, will further, you know, empower that and drive those investments, both in our option and in the core stock.
Anything you want to add in terms of FOX Bet and the future?
So in August, you know, both sides in FOX Bet can decide to move on from that partnership. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, mutually, we're gonna decide to focus on our shareholdings in Flutter and our option in FanDuel.
Cool. I'm gonna talk a bit. Let's go to the network and the entertainment side for a second. You have the cancellation of 9-1-1 and a few other shows on Fox Network. Should we think about a change in programming strategy to lean even more heavily on sports and unscripted and away from scripted content? And, you know, is that the case because you don't own a piece of the economics of scripted? So give us a sense. I know this has been evolving, you know, strategy for you, and you know, Charlie Collier left, Rob Wade's there now. So how are you thinking about programming prime time and the economics of that?
So, you know, the core part of that question, the first part you have to answer in that question for people to understand is that, you know, the Fox Entertainment Network is unlike the other networks in the United States, in that it's 2 hours a night, right? So we don't have the headache or you could argue the opportunity or the challenge of programming the whole day for our affiliates. We program only 2 hours a night. That, by the way, gives our affiliates and our own O&O stations tremendous opportunities, which perhaps I can come to later. But we're only 2 hours a night, and so within those 2 hours, the balance between, you know, unscripted, you know, reality, obviously sports is important, but unscripted reality and scripted dramas and comedies really depends on the economics and on creative choices. So in our upfront, we do have some scripted shows that we're launching, and then we've balanced our returning scripted shows purely based on the economics. So 9-1-1 was very expensive. As shows age, they get more expensive. So you have to refresh them with younger shows. So 9-1-1, we've canceled, but 9-1-1 Lone Star, which is a spin-off that's very successful, which is younger, a younger show, you know, it remains on the schedule. And that's purely because it's great to be number one in broadcast networks, but we also need to do it at the right economics and the right cost.
So you hit on the TV stations. I'm wondering, can you further expand on the strategic value of owning the broadcast network combined with that overlooked TV station portfolio that you have?
Sure. So the broadcast network and the TV stations are they fit, you know, very symbiotically together. The network, obviously, with the sports that we deliver on the network, overlays our footprint for the TV stations, you know, incredibly well. We've designed the TV station group around the NFC, right? So I think we have 15 of 16 NFC markets that we broadcast, you know, on any given Sunday, fits perfectly with our local stations, which obviously drives that local revenue. The fact that we keep our programming to those 2 hours a night allows our local stations to produce and deliver a tremendous amount of local news into the local markets. You know, we think local news is overlooked. It's incredibly important. It's important to local markets. Frankly, it's important to those communities. And we now produce over 1,200 hours of local news a week, local news, and that's very important. What that also does, obviously, it helps the ratings in those markets, particularly as entertainment is softer. But when you enter these political cycles, big political cycles, it's a tremendous position to have, to be the number one local news providers in those markets. And that garners the attention of a lot of the political revenue that we see every... Well, it used to be every four-year big cycle, it's now every 2 years.
So you mentioned before that people may be overlooking the value of the Flutter shares. We often think people overlook the value of the studio lot, which you kept in the Disney deal. Can you talk a bit about the value of owning the lot and now your plans, right? So the lot has a new development plan attached to it as well.
Look, the TV studio lots and TV studio sound stages are only going up in value, right? As you've seen the explosion of subscription video on demand, of scripted and unscripted content, we are the beneficiary of the with our sort of physical infrastructure that we have in Los Angeles. And we can't, you couldn't build enough of them. We, you know, there's not an empty day that they're not leased out to a television producer. It's actually Disney that has the, you know, is the primary tenant on the lot and in those sound stages. And we only wish we could, they could give us back some of their leases because, you know, we'd continue to be able to charge, you know, premiums for that space. So, you know, we think it's a tremendous asset. It's a long-term asset. We've put in a proposed redevelopment of the lot, which really keeps it grounded in television production. It's an important industry in Los Angeles, and it's really going to be the future of that lot for many decades to come, so.
All right, good. So maybe just kind of bringing it all together, wrapping it up, how can you give investors confidence that Fox's EBITDA and free cash flow, something that we focus on a lot, can continue to grow or at least remain stable despite the secular pressures facing the broader ecosystem today?
Well, I think it goes back to the conversation the last half an hour. I think if you look at where we play, where we exist within this broader ecosystem, our focus on live news and live sport give those businesses, you know, tremendous leverage to drive both advertising revenue as audiences are shifting to news and to sport, out of certainly out of linear entertainment. So it gives leverage with our advertisers, but also importantly with our affiliates and distribution partners. So we'll be able to continue to drive premium pricing there. The addition to the company of Tubi has been, you know, incredibly important. Tubi's, I think, exists for about 12 years. We've owned it for about 3 years. You know, not only has the business, I can't remember, it's grown by four times or something. Its growth is accelerating, which is tremendous to see. I think there's reasons for that. It has 55,000 hours of programming on Tubi. That's about five times what Netflix has in their library, and it's free. And I think free is a great positioning market, particularly in uncertain economic times. So we see Tubi continuing to grow, continue to be, you know, a really bright spot in the future of Fox. We're at the beginning of this three-year cycle, and so we're renewing our distribution partners, and we're seeing it work. We're seeing our pricing power be set in the market with contracts and new deals, and we see that continuing over the next few years. So the core business, and I should say on Fox News, you know, the Fox News remains. I've listed the ratings. I'd say they're probably even better now, 10 minutes later, but they're, you know, I don't wanna check. But the Fox News is going incredibly well. We're incredibly proud of the journalism at Fox News, of all of our hardworking journalists there, and Fox News will remain the number one news station, news channel in this country, you know, well into the foreseeable future. So we're very, very happy with our existing core businesses, and then the growth profile of those businesses. But more, you know, just as importantly, you know, our balance sheet is so strong, you know, that we're able to grow. We're able to grow both with you know, prudent, careful, and disciplined organic investment in our businesses, but also M&A. We don't have any large M&A opportunities on the that we're considering today, but we have the ability to, and we're constantly looking. So we can grow organically, we can grow with M&A, and, you know, for shareholders, you know, we can return value, and we can return capital to shareholders, you know, via our dividends and via our continuing share buyback. So when you look across the spread, you know, we think we're incredibly well-positioned, and we're gonna continue to grow.
Awesome. Well, with that-
Great.
Lachlan, thank you for being here. Steve, Dan, Gabby, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.